Cinema Palace, the one that shows all the good-ass movies, the Cine Family, right here on Fairfax Avenue. In the gracious tennis shoe record district of Los Angeles, where Drake will be dropping a jam and you'll be kiping a burger and then later on going over to Cantor's and getting one of their antique sandwiches from their festive collection of historic sandwiches that they serve over at Cantor's, and then possibly having a drink in the kibitz room and letting your life fill out to its full measure here. Then going over to the newsstand on the corner. Oh, it's on here at Fairfax Avenue, ladies and gentlemen. You can also buy all the kosher goods and all the Jewish bric-a-brac you've ever, all the tchotchkes you've ever dreamed of are available here for your perusal here. Tonight, we're going to be showing Joseph Sargent's 1974 thriller, an overlooked gem of the 70s genre of thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123. And it's going to be a fine movie. You may want to dig it up right now if you're out there listening in Proopcast land. This is an awesome time to get some drinks together and perhaps roll one and find an illegal version of this somewhere on the internet for your perusal. I'm almost certain there is one. Is it on Netflix? I know the new one's on Netflix. And let's just talk about the new one and get that over with. I was talking to someone here in Los Angeles today, and as you know, Los Angeles, aside from being the epicenter of show business and being the fulcrum upon which the giant lever of all entertainment is balanced, it is also, thank you. That was a geometry joke for the one Archimedes fan in the room. As well as that, you realize, of course, that Los Angeles is also simultaneously, if you wish to be pretentious, and I do, the most filmy illiterate town that ever fucking walked the face of the earth. You can go to Dayton, Ohio, and there's a club there that's showing Harold and Maude every Thursday night and crying over it, okay? You come to L.A., and a person said to me today, I go, I'm showing the original The Taking of Pelham 123, and she went, I didn't know there was an original. Meaning that I guess the Tony Scott one from several years ago, and God rest his soul, this one's for Tony, spilling some dead for some dead homies. Spilling some body. I saw the remake. I was on a plane, I believe. No, I didn't walk, although I wanted to. If you've seen the remake, there's a couple of things that are different. One, the thrill and the pace are gone, and a horrible infestation destroyed most of the plot. I think cicadas were in the room with the script, and they chewed the script to death. So, but the best part of the new remake is two things. One, Luis Guzman is in it. And Luis Guzman, by the way, should be in everything. And Robbo, why is there a weird sense-around noise going on, like we're showing Earthquake here tonight and Ava Gardner's about to... Okay, there we go. That's over. Luis Guzman should be in everything. And if I haven't told him and I don't know him, and if anyone in this room knows Luis Guzman or his representation, I have a brilliant idea for him for an HBO fucking detective series where he lives in East L.A. and he wears a wife beater and a fucking fedora. Follow me on this. And everybody knows him. Like, there's no case he follows where... Right. He goes on a case and is like, hey, it's me, Tony. Tony, oh, fuck. And, you know, right? Right? It's super... Robbo, seriously. It's super Barrio. And I always thought Luis Guzman would be great in that. Because let's be honest, he's a movie helper. And movies like Out of Sight and shit like that, you're like, oh, thank God Luis Guzman's on screen right now. So he's in the remake, and John Travolta in the remake of The Taking of Pelham 123, and this will be the end of it, is, I think, playing a leather bear from an awesome bar in San Francisco. There's a bar in San Francisco down south of Margaret called The Eagle, and when you drive by The Eagle at 5 in the morning, there are many motorcycles parked out in front, and every man has the facial hair of the leather guy from The Village People. They all have a mutton chop sideburny thing in the leather hat and stuff, and that's what John Travolta's wearing through the whole of the remake of Taking of Pelham 123. Well, having said that, let's get to this one. I don't know that it's the greatest thriller of the 70s, but let me give you an idea about the 70s movie-going experience. A lot of you are quite young or probably born in the 80s and stuff like that. I went to movies all through the 70s because I was 10 to 20 during that decade. Don't start guessing how old I am. Over 100. And... they showed lots of great films then. Buster Keaton's The General, Citizen Kane, The Meles Brothers, A Trip to the Moon. I'm joking, of course. I was taking you back hoping for a laugh on that one, but evidently everyone presumed that I was so old that I remember the dawn of fucking film. We would sit in a room and a man would man a lantern and then music would play from a violinist in the corner. This is the moon. La, da, 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 da. I may have said this before on the show, and if I have, I know it's sad, but I'm going to say it again. I was the critic, the film critic for my high school newspaper for a while, briefly. And yes, I reviewed The Reincarnation of Peter Proud with Michael Sarrazin. Fine motion picture. I also, Jennifer O'Neill's in it, and I think that's all I have to say about that. And for those of you who remember Jennifer O'Neill from the 70s, she was a model who became an actress who became a model while she was acting. And she's in several great movies from that period. She's in Summer of 42, most notably, where she is the older lady, which is hilarious considering she's 20 in the movie or whatever. She's also in a John Wayne movie, Rio Lobos, I think. Golly, it's toward the end. Rio Lobos. And Jackie Lim is the Western actor, and he's in Fritz Lang's Big Heat. He's a gangster actor and then later a Western actor. And the reason why you would know Jackie Lim is one eye goes that way and one eye goes that way. And he's in the beginning of How the West Was Won, right? If you've ever, not How the West Was Won. Help me, Charles Bronson. Once upon a time in the West. Thank you. The opening shots are Jackie Lim and his eyes are all over the fucking yard, right? And in the John Wayne movie, Jennifer O'Neill comes running up the hill and he goes, I was going to shoot you, but you've got the prettiest legs I've ever seen. I remember that line from when I was like 11 years old. We would go to the movies. They cost 50 cents then. And my mom would give me like a dollar. Not kidding, a dollar to go to the fucking movies. Because you call your mother after from the payphone in the lobby. And candy was like 25 cents or whatever. A Coke was a quarter or whatnot. And they would get Red Hots. And Red Hots, I don't know if they still serve Red Hots. Do they have them here? This is the perfect theater, by the way, to recreate the 70s movie experience. For one thing, the projectors don't work. And when the movie starts, there's a big 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then the film burns up in front of you. And a giant hair enters the lens and shit. This happened all the time. And they show fucking short subjects and previews here, which they always showed in the old movie, in the old days. In the 70s, they still showed short subjects. And the candy hair, of course, there's Maltesers. Now there's Kit Kats. We had nothing so fancy as a Kit Kat in those days. Nestle's Crunch was like gourmand, fucking top of the line. And those were 15 cents. They were brutal on your budget of a dollar. I remember when You Only Live Twice came out, they raised the price. Or no, Dr. Dolittle. When Dr. Dolittle came out with Rex Harrison, they raised the price to 75 cents at the Laurel Theater in San Carlos, where I grew up. And I was like, fuck. Because now I had a quarter instead of 50 cents to spend for the rest of the day. And I had to call my mother. But of course, you could always just beg and like go, can we use your phone? Yes, that's right. We would, with our scruffy noses and our little sideways hats and our news sacks. Read all about it in the Evening Herald. Hey, mister, can I use your phone? I gotta call my ma. She'd come down in a... we didn't really have a station wagon, but it's a better story if we did. We had a station wagon. And it had wood on the sides to keep that rustic theme going, as if your team of horses had just up and run away. Looks like we'll have to use this consarned engine in this newfangled vehicle. But I happen to have a soft spot for all the 70s movies because I think when you're little, those are the movies that you first see, and that's why you like them so much. It's not that they're better than any other movies, except that they are. And in my opinion, the movies from my childhood are better than the movies from your childhood. If you grew up in the 90s and shit, really? And if you grew up now, if you're a child and you like were from 10 to 20 in the 2000s and shit, are you really going to come at me with Green Lantern and shit and fucking Silver Linings Playbook and say those are classics that stand the test of time till the fucking... No, you're not. No, you're fucking not. You're going to be embarrassed that you watched Hunger Games and cried with your friends is what's going to happen. Okay? So let me just talk about my decade for a minute, and then we'll get back to your shitty fucking paltry underwritten piece of shit fucking horrible 7,000 remix of Philip K. Dick decade that we're talking about here. This is the decade movies died. And when I say movies, I mean Hollywood movies. And it's really no pity because there's plenty of other kind of good movies and independent movies and foreign films. Movies will never die. It's just that Hollywood does everything it can to put a gigantic male member inside Hollywood's fucking supine opening to take whatever little goodness was left. And nominating 16 to 20 movies each year for the Academy Award, I think is the first sign that desperation has completely set in. What used to be 5 movies, and the 5 movies would be like Apocalypse Now, Apocalypse Now, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, and Serpico. And that's what the 70s were like. Now there's 10 movies, and you're like, really? When The Croods is nominated next year, we'll have this discussion again. Okay? All right? That's all I'm saying. can look up your nose at me all you like, because I'll be looking down mine at yours. There were so many great caper films and action films in the 70s, starting with, of course, and not limited to, The French Connection, The Seven Ups. For caper films, The Anderson Tapes, which I would show here, but I don't think I could get anyone to come. The movie my wife wanted to show was Charlie Varrick, which is part of the great trilogy of Walter Matthau. Thank you. Terse, fucking awesome movies of the 70s. Walter Matthau is, of course, in Charade, where he plays the ratty FBI agent. But he, in the 70s, he's in this picture, The Taking of Pelham 123, which is that New York that I speak of all the time, the one that had the Beretta intro music playing at all times and every minute. Every minute, and then wow. And someone's going to be wearing a tan jacket. Let he who is without sin cast a stone at the first plaid pair of bell bottoms in this fucking movie is all I have to say. When you see one more haircut where there's too much male hair on one side and hardly any on the other, you will know what the 70s were all about. Tan was a very big color, as was plaid, as were giant cuffs, both on your pants, your collar, and on your shirt. The Anderson Tapes I would show, that's a Sean Connery movie where they knock over a high-class apartment building in New York City. And Martin Balsam's in that one. And Martin Balsam's in this movie as well. Hector Elizondo is in this movie. And Hector Elizondo, you've seen in 1,000 movies. Of course, notably, those of you who will remember him in Pretty Woman as the manager of the hotel who shows kindness to Julia Roberts. He's only been in about 450,000 things, including the TV version of Casablanca, where he played Lieutenant Renault. Yes, there was a TV series of Casablanca in the late 70s. Oh, no, we had it all, like Bogey and Bacall. Hector Elizondo was in a TV version and also on the Broadway of a play by Bruce J. Friedman called Steam Bath, where he played a Puerto Rican steam bath attendant who, when you die, you go to heaven, and heaven is a steam bath, and God is a Puerto Rican steam bath attendant. And this will give you an idea of the 70s jokes in the movie. And in the play, he says, how do I know you're God? And a phone drops down, and Hector Elizondo goes, cancel all in the family. That's how you knew he was God. He had the power to cancel all in the family, which was the most popular show in the entire universe at the time. He was nominated. He got a Tony for Steam Bath. He's also a fine guitarist, which I love. Now, he's in a lot of Gary Marshall movies, including... exactly. We're not going to go into Gary Marshall's oeuvre here tonight, although the more said about Exit to Eden, the better. Because it might be one of the great movies that you'll ever... Yeah, it's right up there. When you see Rosie O'Donnell in S&M gear, I don't think your life's ever going to be the same again. All I have to say is try eating breakfast. Just try. And it's not just her, it's everyone. Considered by director-producer Gary Marshall to be his good luck charm, Hector Elizondo appears in so many Gary Marshall films, his credit in the beginning of Exit to Eden, 1994, was, as usual, Hector Elizondo. That's fucking hilarious. What I wanted to talk about a little bit was Robert Shaw, because Robert Shaw, who's the bad guy in this movie, the chief bad guy, had a magnificent career. Not only was he a stage actor in England and Australia, he was an author and wrote 4 novels, including The Man in the Glass Booth, which later became a movie with Maximilian Schell that he was nominated for Best Actor for. Yes, let me open up the globe now and take you on a trip around the world. Let's visit Poland first. Ah, there you are, my little Polish darlings. That's where the alcohol's kept, right here in the globe on stage. Mm. And Robert Shaw drank a lot. Here's Robert Shaw's drink quote about drinking. I was going to say drink about quoting. I drink too much. Will you tell me one great actor who doesn't drink? Evidently, the drinking that went on during all of his movies was fantastic. He wrote The Man in the Glass Booth, and The Man in the Glass Booth was controversial when it came out at the time because you never know whether he's posing as a Nazi or posing as a Jew who's pretending to be a Nazi or posing as a blah, 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 you understand. So they kidnap him, it's like Eichmann, and make him testify in a glass booth at war crimes trials. And Robert Shaw wrote that Just know that while you're watching the movie, that he was a noted author and that he cared a lot about writing as well. He also became an international film star because in the 70s he did Jaws, right after this movie, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, Robin and Marian with Richard Lester, where he plays, of course, the Sheriff of Nottingham. Robert Shaw only played blustery asshole types, basically, in American movies. And awesomely, in The Sting, he's Doyle Lonergan. And Lonergan? Yeah, Lonergan. I'm sorry, Mr. Linneman. It's Lonergan. He was quite a good actor. He's best remembered as being an accomplished writer and supporting actor. His literary contributions include The Man in the Glass Booth. From Russia with Love is where I first saw him when I was a child. And I was my friend Jeff Belton and me would go down to the Laurel Theater, the Carlos Theater in San Carlos, and see all the James Bond films. And now, mind you, that one's pretty early. I was quite young. I saw it after on its re-release. Robert Shaw plays the Russian guy in it. And if you remember, he's Gary Busey in The First Lethal Weapon. He's got the dyed blonde hair, and people punch him in the stomach a lot, and he doesn't react. So he started out playing tough guys and hard guys, and then grew to play a gallery of wild, outrageous characters. He was born, let's see, in Lancashire, blah, 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 blah. This is the part I liked. He was directed by Gielgud, who said to him, "I do admire you and think you've got a lot of ability, and I'd like to help you, but you make me so nervous." You can imagine a young Robert Shaw. When you watch him in the movies, he feels like he's a coiled spring at all times about to fucking... His role as Quint in Jaws... Let's be very honest about Jaws. Jaws is a good movie. It's okay. And when you watch it again, you're scared. He's doing a great deal of the heavy lifting in that fucking movie. Once they get on the boat, the movie takes off. When it's him and the fucking shark, and all of a sudden it's Moby Dick with a rubber shark, and he's fucking Ahab, that's when the movie gets good. All the parts on dry land and shit, yeah, they're good, they're cute, they're fun. When Robert Shaw's like, and does the monologue about the Indianapolis, which evidently he partially improvised. I'm not certain of that, but that's what I've been reading today. He improvised a lot on the picture, and he was quite a good writer, as stated. When he was making The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, he said to Hector Elizondo, he said, "I've never," he goes, "they want me to make this fish movie." And Hector Elizondo goes, "Why don't you want to do it?" And he says, "I've never heard of the fucking director. And I hate the title. It's called Jaws." Steven Spielberg wasn't famous yet then. And it only made, what, Sugarland Express and Duel, maybe? And that awesome Night Gallery episode with Joan Crawford. Let's not forget that one. It made $100 million worldwide, and it was the first movie, Jaws, to gross $100 million. He didn't make any money, Robert Shaw, because he didn't have a piece of it, and he'd been working all over the world, and taxes fucked him. Then he made The Deep later on, which is another Peter Benchley movie, several years later. And The Deep is not a great movie. He kept saying to Nick Nolte while they're making the movie, because it wasn't going well, the shoot. They shot in, where did they shoot? Bermuda. It's a treasure movie. It's a treasure movie, Nick. Don't worry about it. Imagine being with Nick Nolte and Robert Shaw in Bermuda during the shooting, yes, of The Deep. You can imagine all you like about the drinking and the coking. What I'm imagining is Jacqueline Bisset getting up every morning and like a fawn coming out on her patio, shaking her mane of brunette hair back and then putting on a groovy bikini and getting ready to shoot. If you've ever seen the movie The Deep, and I can only gather by the quietude of this fucking crowd that you've never seen the movie The Deep, and you have good reason not to see it, understand that Jacqueline Bisset wears a white t-shirt underwater in the movie. I don't know if I've made myself clear. I saw Jacqueline Bisset at the Whole Foods in Beverly Hills 2 years ago, and she looked fucking awesome. Her hair was wild as shit, like she had just, I don't know, done a mad bucko bronking rodeo ride. You know what I mean? Like, all I could presume was that something groovy had just happened because her hair was flowing freely, and I had a fucking heart attack. That's all I have to say about it. This is what I mean about the 70s, you guys. But we have Reese Witherspoon now. Tremendous. That must really hot you up in the dead of night. What if I told you Reese Witherspoon was in a white t-shirt in an undersea treasure movie? Yeah, that was someone went, eh. And it's nothing against Reese Witherspoon. It's just that she shouldn't be in an undersea treasure movie with a white t-shirt on. Jacqueline Bisset should have, would have, fucking did, okay? No Oscars were handed out for that. More's the fucking pity. Moore is the fucking pity. This director, Joseph Sargent, made 1,000 television movies and Jaws the Revenge is his other, yes. So there's a lot of Jaws going on in this movie, one way and another. But when you watch it, you'll find none, because basically it's in a subway train in New York. So Robert Shaw died too early and was a tremendous actor. What was I going to say here? There's an actor named Ian Shaw. Do we know him? All right, never mind. Many of Captain Quint's ramblings in Jaws were actually Shaw's improvisations. He's considered one of many authors of the famous Indianapolis scene. In the town of West Houghton in England, there's a pub called the Robert Shaw. I know, someone went, exactly. That was the proper reaction. One day we'll all have a drink at the Robert Shaw. One day we'll all have many drinks, and then we'll take the can and we'll crush it like that. His other great quote was, "What I've tried to achieve in acting, flamboyance, would be self-indulgence if I tried it as a writer." Yes, I should think so. Considering the movie scene we all remember you for is when you're running your fingers down a chalkboard in Jaws and then go, "I want to find a shark. Another shark. Your chiefy. Oh, chiefy. Chiefy." May I ask what country he's from in that movie? He's from England, Scotland, Cheshire, land. He's from Nipton on the Ween. Walter Matthau, what can I tell you? The film's closing credits have a... What is there not to say about Walter Matthau? Not only did he make Charlie Varick and The Laughing Policeman, which are his three great terse movies of the 70s, and Taking a Pill in 1, 2, 3, he then went on to make The Bad News Bears, which is, amazingly good. And I think on this anniversary of Jackie Robinson, this is the first day Jackie Robinson played in the big leagues in 1947, there's no greater baseball movie than you can mention than The Bad News Bears. Because it had an alcoholic coach and lesbianic children. And I don't think you can ask any more from any baseball movie. Walter Matthau had not been on the New York subway in many years at the time this movie was made, even though he was born and raised in New York. Ever since the release of the film, no number 6 train has ever been scheduled to leave Pelham Bay Park Station at 1323 or 0123. They really hesitate to have a Pelham 123. Because they know John Travolta has had his head shaved and is waiting with a leather jacket on with Luis Guzman. Another 70s riff in this movie. In the subway car, there's a poster of Iron Eyes Cody, who played the crying Indian, in the public service announcements from the 70s. Thank you. In the 70s, on telly, they would show a garbage everywhere in a park and shit, and like refuse falling on the ground. There was, for some reason, the 70s were really about, one, the ecology, and two, litter. Litter was really important. We were going to keep America beautiful. And that was by picking up litter and putting it in a trash, in a waste basket. Sometimes in grade school, when I was in grade school, a waste paper basket. And we actually had a waste paper basket monitor when I was a small child. It was not an elected position. It was really more ceremonial. They had to wear a little croix de guerre, and that my teacher would kiss them on either cheek. And see what you missed? We had phones and shit, really? We had overhead projectors that the teacher would spit on. Spit on the screen and then wipe it in front of you. And you'd be like, "That's so gross. That's so gross that you spit on that to wipe it off." The Beastie Boys. Let's get right to the heart of the matter. On the album Ill Communication, and I don't think anyone could ever forget it, the second verse is the King Ad Rock, and he says, "It's like the taking of the Pelham 1, 2, 3, and if you want the duty rhyme, then come see me. I got the savoir faire," right? The fact that the Beastie Boys are younger than me and all of their references are older than I am makes me love them more than any group that ever lived. It's like a pinch on the neck from Mr. Spock, they say in one of their... of course they would reference the taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, because the next line, I believe 2 verses later, he says, I'm what is it? I direct like action like my man John Woo, and I got mad hits like I was Rod Carew. FYI, Rod Carew hit 388 in 1977. I know it's not a big cinematic point. I've made myself snork. This is an article Roger Ebert wrote upon Walter Matthau's demise. I thought I'd quote you a couple of things. Yes, Roger Ebert was lovely in the last podcast that hasn't come out yet. I discuss him at length in Chicago. Matthau was a favorite actor of two giants of American comedy, director Billy Wilder and playwright Neil Simon. He made three films with Wilder and starred in the screen versions of five Neil Simon comedies. He recalled meeting Neil Simon for the first time at a New York party. The conversation consisted of Simon saying, "You ought to be in my next play." And Matthau replied, "Who are you?" Later, when we were doing The Odd Couple, he said to Neil Simon, "I don't want to play Oscar. I want to play Felix. Because Felix is, Oscar's too easy. He gets all the laughs. Felix, the hard part, that's the part I want to play." And Neil Simon said to him, "Walter, do me a favor. Act on your own time." Which is like a Neil Simon line. He apparently, and this is the part I thought would blow your mind here, Matthau was an inveterate gambler. According to this, he lost, according to him, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million gambling. And you think, how did you make $50 million? $500 a game top, sometimes $1,000, no heart attack bets. Do you follow basketball pretty closely? Matthau, pretty closely. How many games did Indiana lose during the regular season? 9. What scores do you want to know? Fantastic. He lied every time anyone asked him about his upbringing. Evidently, anyone asked him what his name was or what he really was, no one even knows what Walter Matthau's real name was. He says it was, according to this one, it's Walter Matuchanakayaski. But I've read lately that that's not true, that it was actually Matthau with a T-H-O-W, and that he just made it up every fucking time. And for that, I love him. Hello, Dolly, A New Leaf, Earthquake, Holy Kittens, The Laughing Policeman, Taking a Pelham 123, The Bad News Bears, House Calls with Glenda Jackson. Glenda Jackson was enormously popular as a romantic comedy lead after doing a movie called A Touch of Class in the mid-70s and then made House Calls with Walter Matthau ever. She is currently sitting as a member of Parliament in England and has been for 20 years. Hampstead, my old neighborhood in London, NW3 is her bailiwick. And when Margaret Thatcher died, if anyone watched, Glenda Jackson got up and gave a very fervent and impassioned speech about what a fascist Margaret Thatcher had been. So Glenda Jackson was not only an Oscar-winning actress twice in the American pictures and a superb actor all around. You should see her, Queen Elizabeth, if you ever get a chance. The tall actress, Vanessa Redgrave plays, you love how my mind works, the tall actress. You know, the one with the red hair. Vanessa Redgrave plays Mary Queen of Scots in her Elizabeth one, and she has her aced. And Glenda Jackson's one is really good. Also, Hedda Gabler, Georgie, The Devils. I can think of about 1,000 Glenda Jackson movies. You should see The Turtle Diaries. In my opinion, Faye Dunaway and Glenda Jackson are the two greatest actresses of the 70s. There's a lot of great actresses, but they really kick it around the yard. Is Glenda Jackson in this movie tonight? No, she's not. And it's about time you cue it up, because we're about to spin this fucker. But before we do, let me just tell you a couple places we're going to play here. We're at the Bar Lubitsch on Wednesday. That's not for the people who are listening, because this will come out far after that. But for you, here tonight, the living. We won't be showing a movie, but it'll just be me talking for 2 hours. Can you imagine? You mean we don't even get Martin Balsam and Hector Elizondo to break up the fucking monotony of your talking? No. And you don't even get 20-minute breaks where we show the movie and then I get on the mic again and talk in between. We'll be at Good Nights in Raleigh, North Carolina on the 9th of May. On the 21st of May at the D.C. Improv in Washington, D.C. On the 25th of May at the Bell House in Brooklyn. And no sleep till. We'll be showing Dog Day Afternoon here on May 28th. Sidney Lumet's amazing. I'm on a 70s jag. My wife picked all these movies. Dog Day, I don't know if you call it a caper film or a psychosexual thriller or what the fuck you'd call Dog Day, but Sidney Lumet is one of the maybe greatest, in my opinion. I don't know if he's undersung as a director, but every one of his movies has social content. The thing about this movie, Taking a Pelham 123, this is a straight-up caper film. Dog Day is about a lot of things, including sexual politics and LGBT, what do we call them now? LGBT rights and, you know, I mean, it is a deep fucking film and amazingly entertaining. And it's Al Pacino when Al Pacino was Al Pacino before the wigs. Not that he's not good now. I watched this Phil Spector movie a couple of weeks ago because I had to. I put black music. It was fucking good. It was good. It was good. It was good. Helen Mirren was struggling. She was miscast. It was supposed to be Bette Midler, and it should have been. Helen Mirren, I had no idea was in the fucking movie, but why she was in it. But Al Pacino was groovy in it. Dog Day, we're going to show on the 28th. The 18th and 23rd will be at the Soho Theater in London, should you come to London. On the 27th of June, we'll be at the Dines Theater in Amsterdam for what I think will be a 7.5-hour podcast. Thank you, the two people who got that. Why will it be so long, Greg? Because I'll be so high that I won't shut up. If you think I can go on and on about Robert Shaw now in a non-humorous way, wait till I get to Amsterdam. Then every detail of every movie that I ever saw will be related. Did I mention there was wood on the sides of the station wagon? It was a Vista Cruiser. It also had a window up on the top so you could watch the telephone wires go by. That was for safety. On the 29th of June, we'll be in Norway at Oslo in a theater that I cannot pronounce the name of. And it'll be a lot of money. It'll be 20 kronen. The 31st of July to the 15th of August, we'll be at Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Festival, with podcasts on the 3rd, the 9th, and the 15th. If you wish to write me personally, poisonally, it's smartest@aspecialthing.com. Oh, no, that's for the ask a question on the show. We're not doing them tonight, but we do sometimes. If you want to write me poisonally, it's fanmail4greg@gmail.com. And I do read all my emails. This, we were trying to figure out how many movies we showed in the Greg Proops Film Club. And I hope that you've liked the ones that we've showed. I felt quite awful because we showed With Nail and I last year. And then we actually put it out a couple of weeks ago. And Richard Griffiths passed away right after I put it out. So I'm terrified to show this movie tonight. Because Hector Elizondo is the last member of this gang that's still alive. So I'm hoping that he'll carry on for many more years. So far, we've showed Buckaroo Banzai, With Nail and I, Annie Hall, Gilda, The Big Sleep, Point Break, Return of the Living Dead we showed for Halloween, Scrooge for Christmas, and now this one. So if you're getting ready, cue it up right now. Now's the time to light one up. Everyone here in the audience is going to get ready for the previews because we're going to show Joseph Sargent's 1974 classic starring the awesome Robert Shaw and the inimitable Walter Matthau, one of the terse great 70 thrillers, The Taking of Pelham 123. Yes. Thank you so much. It is that good. And next month, Dog Day Afternoon. Really. What else can you say? We'll just talk for a couple of minutes and then we'll blow. The ending of the movie, Gesundheit, right? Because the movie starts with Martin Balsam and he leads you in with the sneezing right away. What is it in the first scene where he says, well, what did you get suspended for? And Martin Balsam starts to tell the conductor, the grip man, the motorman, Mr. Doyle. And Mr. Blue goes, why don't you tell him all about yourself, Mr. Green? That's what makes it so awesome. That and freeze frame on Walter Matthau going, Geheim, Flavor Schleiming, Geheim. Yeah. I just really feel like there's a certain field of 70s terse action films that no other decade really recalls, and there's a special kind of sassiness that everyone has, including every passenger and every hostage on the train. And when you saw them listed at the end, co-ed number one, co-ed number two, the homosexual, the pimp and the hooker. It's the all-ethnic platoon. Robbo will take your questions or comments if you have any, and then we'll blow into this good night. Does anyone want to say anything? Here we go. Yeah, there's someone in the back. Thank God you're still alive. It's been a very long hostage crisis here tonight, yeah. As we've been held through every real change. What's your name, sir?
Ted.
Ted, yeah. I'm going to call you Mr. Violet, if I may. Go on, Mr. Violet.
Second thing is, I went to elementary school.
So this is a compound question.
The second part isn't a question, but it might be of interest. I went to elementary school with a kid named Rich Heck, whose father did a good portion of the stunt driving in this movie. You know, remember in the 70s, Evel Knievel, obviously, and all the stunt thrill shows, the Thunderbirds, the Blue Angels, all this stuff. Well, the two main stunt drivers had a thing called Joey Chitwood's Thrill Show. Joey was spelled in the female version of Joey, but he was very much a man, J-O-I-E if you check the credits. Joey Chitwood and his brother, and then my elementary school friend's name, father's name was Tim Heck. And they did all the stunt driving on the West Side Highway.
Were they New York based, or did you go to school on the East Coast?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, so they were, because this movie's so unbelievably New York. Not a second of it has any Hollywood about it at all. That's awesome. And he was in a stunt driving team, you say?
Joey Chitwood's Thrill Show.
Joey, J-O-I-A.
J-O-I-E.
Like my cousin Joey, who changed her name for Mary Jo.
Yeah, and they do things like carnivals and fairs.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Go up on two wheels, whatnot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, fuck yeah, that's awesome. What was the first question? Because the answer is yes. My understanding is it's this, and I think there's a Hong Kong film, too,
right,
that has Mr. Black and Mr. White and all that. This is definitely the progenitor of Mr. Black and Lawrence Tierney and the whole Reservoir Dogs thing. I think it's the first great caper film where they use the colors as names. And they stick with it till the bloody, bitter, bloody, and as I said, were you not rooting for Martin Balsam to get away with it at the end? Even though he took all the money, when he kicks the wad of money under the bed, you think, oh, fuck yeah, we're going to get away with it, man. We're going to get the money. And then you're like, oh, God, he lives in this horrible house with a weird bottle of whiskey over his thing and canned foods on his refrigerator. What's he going to do with all the money? Yeah. Like, where's he going to go, Atlantic City? That's so awesome about your friend from grade school. Anyone else? And then we'll blow. Oh, we have a couple more. Look at this.
Hi, Greg. It's Lewis.
Hi, Lewis. And thank you for the book.
Oh, I can't tell you
how much I appreciate it. Lewis gave me a copy of The Devil in Love, and it was exactly the copy that my wife, that I had lost from my wife years before in a hotel room. This means nothing to you people, but years before, I had a copy of The Devil in Love by Gazzott, and he found me another copy, and let me just extend my gratitude to you.
My pleasure.
I take time out during my podcast that I broadcast to people in Uganda to personally interact with the people in the audience here. It's not just all show business and me being unbelievably vibrant. There's moments of real. Yes, Lewis. I'm afraid we don't have time for your question now, Lewis. Go on, Lewis.
Your comment about movie music from the 70s, factions and thrillers, this had very little twangy guitar, if you notice, maybe one scene in the command center. But most of it was balls-to-the-wall music. And David Shire, before this, he had done The Conversation, which was completely different.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Robbo was raving about David Shire before the show. David Shire did a tremendous job on the score here. This one's all, what is it, trombone and French horn? Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. All percussion.
Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah.
It's just great.
It really is. I'm partial to Dave Grusin's score to the 3 Days of the Condor, too, which is a movie I would show if given half a second and watch over and over again, if only for Max von Sydow's performance in that movie. But this one's pretty terse. There's not a lot of music in it at all, really, at any point. And there's fantastic 70s racial jokes, which don't play anymore. And that makes it even better, really. One more, and then we'll go. Someone else? Or no? Oh, yes? Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, just a comment. I noticed that the mayor's wife was Doris Roberts.
Yes.
From Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yes, the mayor's wife is Doris Roberts.
Just a trifecta of TV people. Well, actually, including the actor, I guess.
It's every New York stage actor from the early 70s in New York who later went on to have awesome careers in Hollywood. Evidently, after this movie wrapped, everyone got on a plane and came to Los Angeles, and then was in a sitcom or a drama show for the rest of their lives here. It is that movie. Wow, how many mics do you have, Robbo? I love it. Look at him run. Look at him skeet.
Hey, I'm Rob.
Hi, Rob.
I live across the street.
You live where?
Across the street.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, in
the bank across the street? All right. You don't live in Golden State, the hamburger place across the street.
No, no.
You don't live in Damiano's Pizza, do you?
No, no. Because
when I first moved here, there was a vampire who worked there, which I thought... Because Damiano's is open until 5 in the morning for delivery, and I would order sometimes at 4:30 in the morning, and then you think, you really shouldn't order from a place where there's a known vampire. You don't know what you're going to get. So, just a safety tip. I don't have that much useful information. Go on, Rob.
So, you mentioned about racial stereotyping. Would you say this is one of the films that kind of virtually pioneered the racial stereotyping in 70s films?
Oh, certainly not. Oh, no, my goodness, no. If you've ever seen any of the blaxploitation movies, I think they really, the pale has been beyond, is reached. It's just in keeping with all of them. Again, I understand that white men in the 70s were having to deal with things like black people and women in the workplace and stuff like that. And so it was a constantly hilarious joke that never got old. The black cop going, "I'm not that easy to see in the dark" and shit. That was a fucking thigh slapper in 1974. It's not quite as funny now. Unless you're going to watch Scary Movie 8 or one of those weird, you know, parody movies where the jokes are on that level. But no, I just think this one included it. And in a more right-on way than I even had remembered. Because the police detective who's in inspector who's in charge of the whole chasing the subway train down is a black guy with a cigar. Which is, as we know, later evolved into a pone in the first Alien movie. No, I think it just plays along all those stereotypes. Those stereotypes are still being played out. You might have also noticed something else in the early 70s that died out by now, which is everyone's wearing a hat. We think of that as 40s and 50s movies because JFK is the one who's responsible, supposedly, for the hat being over because JFK didn't wear a hat. He's the last president. He wore a top hat at his inaugural, but he didn't wear a hat day to day. Like Ike wore a hat and shit like that. All presidents wore hats. When JFK quit wearing them, that was the end of hats in the United States. And yet, as you see, 15 years later, everyone in New York City, when they change out of their disguises at the end, Robert Shaw goes, "New hats?" and takes off his little tie roll and puts on a kicky Greek fisherman. Kicky Greek fisherman to get killed in at the end when he does his weird sadomasochistic third rail thing. So I think the groove of that came back, obviously. Now, if you walk down the street here at Fairfax in the daytime, you will see people unironically dressed as the cast of the kidnappers and hijackers from Pelham 123 walking down the street wearing little fucking tie rolls and Greek fisherman hats with plaid pants on and shit like that with no remorse. And the same 70s glasses and weird porn stashes are worn again with no irony. And yet in those days, you had to be either Steve Prefontaine or Harry Reams to wear a mustache like that, in my opinion. Or Andrea Dworkin. Yeah, that was just fucking cheaper than fuck. I guess it's late. Is that it then? If it is, well, anyone else? Because if we don't... who had in the train station? I don't know if it was. No, in the train command center. Who, by the way, if you noticed, was using a 1920s Elliot Ness phone to talk to the command center on. She actually had a 1920s Hey Rico fucking mouth set on the fucking phone in the 70s. Yeah. No, it wasn't on us. It was on Esther. What, I can't remember that actress's name.
Luanda
Page. I believe it was Luanda Page.
It was not Luanda Page.
Thank you, Robbo. Robbo scoured the credits before the showing of this movie and went through everything. And I'm assured that it's not Luanda Page. However, that woman was in a Luanda Page lookalike contest not 2 years later and received third place money. That's my understanding. This has been the Greg Proops Film Club. You have been the most awesome audience in the world. This has been the Taking a Pen of 1, 2, 3. We'll be back in a month's time for Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino by Sidney Lumet. Good night, everybody. May every page that you turn be a special page. I love you. Good night.